Welcome back from Thanksgiving, everyone. We're glad to have you here. This is the hashtag SDR Ask podcast, and I'm Amy Hall.
With Famous Amos.
Oh, no.
Not the cookie. And Greg Hochul.
Yes.
Riding shotgun here.
Yes, Greg.
To the famous Amos. I'm doing great. Thank you. And I am really excited because I have in my hand the much weightier second edition of Tactics, a Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions. Much weightier than the first because it's got 40% more material. I've doubled the number, almost doubled. If you take Columbo out and have all the other tactics, I've doubled the number of tactics in the book. I have 6 new chapters. I'm so thrilled. And you worked on with me on this in the edit, and your help is always invaluable. So people like the way this reads. Amy has contributed a tremendous amount to that. But those folks who got the first tactics, God bless them. But they need this one too. And the reason is there are so many improvements. I go into a lot more detail on a very foundational concept, Amy, that I called gardening versus harvesting, and a whole bunch of other stuff. So I'm just thrilled that this actually launched last week on Tuesday, the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. And I just would like to make a special request to our listeners who found this book really helpful in the first edition. First, I already mentioned my first request, get the second edition, okay? But what would help me tremendously is on Amazon, where people go to find out what people think about books and whether they should buy the book or not based on the reviews. Amazon starts all over with a new edition. That means I lose 500, more than 500, 525 or 26 5-star recommendations, which was almost 90% of the recommendations from the first edition. And that means I start empty. And what my request is, if you as a listener like the book, even if you don't get the new one, if you like the first one, all of the first ones in the second, but improved. So if you would please go in on Amazon and weigh in with your opinion such as it is. I'm not going to tell you to give 5 stars. You give what you like. But people mostly do give 5 stars because they really like it. I just want to get some activity there. And one other thing that would really be helpful, if you would read another review that is more extensive, that's a 5-star review. And if you click it as helpful, what Amazon does is the reviews that get the most helpful clicks go to the top of the list. That means when you open it up and a 5-star review gets the most helpful button pushes, then that will be the first thing that people see. Anyway, that would be something that would help me tremendously. And if you wanted to blog or just let other people know about the new edition, that would be great too.
It actually occurs to me that there could be people listening to this show right now who have no idea what you're talking about. They don't even know about tactics.
Huh.
And at the risk of this sounding like a commercial, because this is not a commercial, I mean this absolutely 100%. When I got my degree at Biola,
I'm handing her money right now as we're speaking. You can't see this.
The tactics material that I learned from you was the most important thing I learned there.
Hmm.
Because you can always pick up information. You can always learn things. You're going to forget things.
Right.
But how you use that information in conversation, that is something that applies to every conversation you'll have with everybody. And it's been so valuable in my life and in other people's lives. And so I do recommend, if you've never heard of tactics,
right,
I recommend that book very highly.
The subtitle is A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions, and it is exactly that. It is a plan that allows you to maneuver in conversations with grace, with comfort, without getting in fights with people, and in a way that is very, very effective, based on the testimonies of multitudes that have talked to me personally over the last 10 years. So there you go.
Okay. Well, let's get started with some questions now.
All right.
And this first one, I actually got several questions about this topic. So I picked one of them because it seems like people are really interested in this question.
Okay.
This one is from Mortal Fool. I know you are a substance dualist, as am I. I've heard some say three parts, body, mind, spirit. Do you understand, and can you explain what they mean by mind versus spirit?
Well, there is a little bit, I don't know if controversy is the right word because that's too strong, but there are differences of opinion about this in Christian circles. I will tell you the standard view is that human beings are made of two substances, okay? A substance is a thing where a quality, a property is a quality, all right? So Amy's a thing with greenish, brownish eye. What color is that? Never mind. Brown hair. All right. That's pretty obvious. All right. So the fact that her hair is brown is an accidental property. Could have been other colors. But the fact that she is a human being is an essential quality of the substance she is, the kind of thing she is, all right? So substance dualism says that there is a substance, a thing that is a physical thing that is part of being human, and that there is a non-physical thing that is part of being human. And so our identity is grounded in the non-physical thing, because when the physical thing, our body, dies, even though we are, in a sense, lacking something that is essential to being human for the time being, there's a tearing apart in an unnatural way between the soul and the body. Our identity follows our body. We are still ourselves when we absent from the body, present with the Lord. Okay, so the scripture refers to the non-physical part in multiple ways. It refers to it as the soul or the mind or the spirit. These are almost always interchangeable, all right? That is, they're synonyms for each other. They're different ways of describing the immaterial self. Sometimes we see the word spirit and soul distinguished from each other, and Hebrews 4:12 is an example where you see a distinction there. And this is where I think it's best to understand that distinction, not as having an additional substance. So we have a body, and we have a soul, and we have a spirit. Because then where is our ego? Where is our self located? Where is our individual self? It would have to be in both, it seems to me. But in any event, it's better to understand the spirit as a faculty of the soul. And this is the way most Christian writers and thinkers take it. Here's the difficulty, I think, in understanding the spirit as a separate thing. So tripart human being in rather than a dualistic human being, is the spirit is, then there's a temptation to give the spirit certain qualities that make the way of understanding being human more Gnostic than Christian. Now, Gnosticism is a second century heresy that identified the flesh as bad and the spirit as good, all right? And this is why they didn't believe Jesus really had a genuine human body. He only appeared to have that. That was a heresy called Docetism, and because the flesh is evil. And the pattern that I've seen is that we look at ourselves, our S-E-L-F, as all F-L-E-S-H. We are all flesh, and that can't be trusted, but the spiritual part of us can be trusted because it's renewed. So it's almost like we're going, when you have this division, this threefold division, the spirit takes on a different kind of role that turns out to be non-biblical and leads to error. Okay, like the spirit is what's pure and good in us. It's what God gives us. But the soul and the flesh and the body are fallen parts of the flesh. No, I do agree with that. And it won't be until the resurrection that the body and soul are redeemed and made whole. But I don't agree that there is a separate substance called the Spirit, which Spirit is somehow more reliable and less corrupted than the other ones. And that's an error that people fall into when they try to hive off this third substance called the Spirit, when it doesn't seem there's biblical justification for that.
You said the Spirit is a faculty of the soul. Can you explain more what you mean by that?
Well, the soul, here's the way J.P. Moreland puts it. It's kind of an illustration, but if you think of it like a dresser with different drawers, all right? So the dresser would be the whole immaterial self, and the immaterial self has different faculties. It does different things. It has thoughts. It has feelings, emotions, acts of will, all kinds of capacities to do things. So we have a capacity for language, for example, that is realized when the physical body is able to take use of the soulish capacity to speak and then begins to speak, that, all of those kinds of things. And so the spirit capacity seems to be that capacity that is regenerated at the new birth, and that gives us the ability to connect with God in a vital way. And this gives us a deeper understanding of things. It's the regeneration of our immaterial selves, not our physical selves, but our physical selves will be regenerated in a similar fashion at the resurrection. But the regeneration of the soul happens with the new birth. And with the new birth, the spiritual faculty is vivified. It's made alive so that now we have the capability of connecting with God and have that faculty actually grow in its strength and its abilities. And that's what spiritual growth and sanctification amount to.
So then you would say the spirit would be a subset of the soul, like our rationality or anything like that.
Okay. That's right.
Okay, thank you, Greg. Here's a question from Steve Van Kulin. How does mental disability, from severe to basic clinical depression, affect salvation and being able to understand necessary truths?
Well, there is this. It's interesting that this question comes on the heels of the first one, because this is all relates to mind-body dualism. That is, there are two parts to being human, and they both are deep. They're separate, they're distinct, but they are connected in really profound ways and in deep and meaningful ways. And this is the way God intended. There's a deep unity between them, such that the mind can affect states of the body, and states of the body can affect the mind. Now, this is, of course, is obvious. If someone's vocal cords are removed, even though a person has a capacity for speech, they're not going to be able to talk because they don't have the machinery anymore to do that. And by the same token, that's just a simple illustration. But there are all kinds of things that can go wrong with the brain and central nervous system, which are the complex machinery that the soul uses to accomplish complex functions that relate to the mind. So if there is mental illness, then those functions are impaired, all right? Maybe we can't think as clearly as we used to. A perfect example is Alzheimer's disease, okay? So you have, I don't have any reason to believe that something's wrong with the mind proper. Keep in mind, when people talk about Alzheimer's disease, the tendency is to think about it in strictly physicalistic terms, okay? But from a dualist perspective, in other words, there's no soul, it's just all body. And so if it's meat all the way down, so to speak, and you have Alzheimer's disease, then the totality of the explanation of Alzheimer's is there's a misfunctioning of the brain, and that's it. There's a deterioration. But I think what happens is there is a deterioration of the brain, but what it affects is the ability of the soul to use the brain and the body to accomplish the soul's normal functions. The soul can be fine, but something going on in the body is inhibiting the soul from accomplishing its function. What's interesting, by the way, is in near-death experiences, particularly where you have a kind of near-death experience where you have what's called remote viewing, where the soul separates from the body and is at a different location. The location may be above the body in the surgery room, maybe down the street. It could be across the state, observing things that it can report through the body when they're rejoined. And this becomes evidential information for the legitimacy of this out-of-body experience. But there are people who are physically blind that when they have a remote viewing experience, a separation of the soul from the body, they can actually see. They can see what's going on. That's how they can report what's going on. And so this is an example of how the physical body can be impaired, limiting the soul's ability while in the body, in so to speak, unified with the body. And when the soul is released from the body temporarily because of this unusual experience, the soul then regains the faculties that the body had inhibited. And there's lots and lots of evidence for this. So this confirms more in an evidential way our understanding of the relationship of the soul and the body when they're unified together.
So let's bring this to his question about how does this affect salvation?
Yeah, I don't think it affects salvation personally, and because people can be regenerate and still have all kinds of disabilities in their body. You can have a person who is a Christian who loves Jesus and completely loses the function of their normal faculties because they have Alzheimer's disease. And but that there's no reason to think that that's going to affect reverse their regeneration or something. And in my view, that's irreversible anyway. Mm-hmm. But even for those who think that it is reversible, Arminians and the like, characteristically, it still would be no justification to think that there is a reversal simply because one's faculties, because of physical problems, mental mm-hmm. illness, mental degradation like Alzheimer's disease or any other loss of faculty would indicate loss of salvation.
So what about people becoming Christians? It's unclear to me if he's talking about whether it would affect the salvation you already have, or how does this affect people's ability to want to be with God? I mean,
right. Well,
the ability to understand necessary truths is what he puts it here.
Sure. Yeah, that has to do with the reasoning facility, the faculty, and whatever. And I think this is in the same general category as what happens to babies who die. You know, the principle there is there needs to be a functional mental capacity that allows the individual to really comprehend the difference between right and wrong, and then along with that, the accompanying concept of forgiveness and trust. So in Isaiah 7:16 or somewhere right in there, right after the virgin shall give birth part, there is a reference to a child who will be born, and before he is able to determine good from evil, and then the narrative continues. So that is a biblical reference to a common sense notion that there is a developmental stage at which this seems to be something that happens. Okay, now we kind of get it. Now, that developmental stage in some people may never happen. Severely mentally retarded or mentally ill people or congenitally defected, you know what I'm talking about, people may not ever reach that level. And in that case, they're just like an infant who dies at birth, in my view, at least.
And I just want to add, too, that God is not limited by our fallenness, whether that's a physical, you know, disability, or it's just the fact that we're fallen and we hate God and we're against mm-hmm. him. If he wants to save someone, he will do that mm-hmm. by his grace.
Right.
And so I don't think you know, if we have loved ones who are mentally ill, that we need to despair, because with man, that is impossible, but with God, all things are possible.
Sure. It does somewhat depend on the level of mental illness, because children can certainly comprehend right from wrong and forgiveness and the like, even at a very young age. And so if you have a mentally ill adult that has the mental capacity of a 9-year-old, well, that person is probably capable of understanding these kinds of things, but not in a very sophisticated way, which is okay. So anyway, just another thought.
Well, thank you, Greg. We're out of time.
Amy, you're welcome.
Thanks for all your answers. And thank you, everyone, for all your questions. We really appreciate those. So keep sending those on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.